All right, cool. So as Fernando said, I've been at Facebook since 2010. And before Facebook, I co-founded a company called ReCAPTCHA, which provided those like squiggly letters you type when you sign up for things, you buy tickets on Ticketmaster or whatnot. At Facebook, I'm the tech lead on the Web Foundation team, which Fernando said is kind of in the middle of all the different infrastructure teams at Facebook. And we're sort of responsible for the overall reliability and performance of Facebook's user-facing products. And so to me, that really means that we have two big portions of our work. One thing is we have a lot of proactive work. We work with a lot of Facebook's infrastructure teams to help them build reliable and resilient services and to build good monitoring so that we can tell when they fail. And the second part is when stuff does actually fail, we help debug things. If there's a problem that maybe it doesn't have a root cause, but it's affecting the overall performance of Facebook, we will debug it and help work with the correct team to help fix the issue. Or also help teams with sort of deep systems level expertise. We find ourselves handling a lot of low level systems issues, and we try to spread that expertise around Facebook. So today I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about some ideas we use to build reliable services and build reliable services by making them fail faster. I want to talk a little bit about our approach to investigating problems. And then I want to talk about incident management. What do we do when something actually goes wrong and how do we learn from it? So when you're building systems, I think that failing fast is something that's really important. And in a car collision, if the car's going 60 miles per hour, there's this physics concept called conservation of energy, which says that the kinetic energy of that car has to go somewhere. When a large distributed system fails, that failure has to be absorbed by some part of the system. And cars have a crumple zone, a part of the car that's designed to absorb the energy of an impact so that it doesn't affect the passenger of the car. So I like to think about building crumple zones for our infrastructure. So one of the things that we've found is that queuing is often an instigator or something that amplifies slowness. And the reason behind this is intuitive. A lot of services tend to have a thread pool of worker threads that they can use to service their requests. And if you didn't have a queue, they would be bounded by that number of threads. They could at most be sort of blocking N people. But with queuing, they can just have an infinite list of requests waiting to execute and cause sort of an infinite amount of slowness throughout the system. So I think queuing really falls into kind of two categories of good queuing and bad queuing. Good queuing is transient. It deals with a burst of load. It deals with a system that is actually processing speed is actually greater than the arrival speed of the request into the system. Good queuing increases reliability by buffering a temporary problem in a system. Bad queuing is when you queue forever. Bad queuing is a system that is fundamentally broken. It fundamentally cannot handle the load it is trying to handle. Bad queuing causes latency, but it doesn't increase the throughput of the service that you're dealing with. It doesn't increase the reliability. It simply makes the system slower for everyone. So we've implemented a few mechanisms that control queuing and that help avoid having it cause a problem for our users. One of these things, and this is some code we've actually open sourced as part of our Thrift framework, which is a RPC framework we use to communicate between different servers. And this is a mechanism for controlling the amount of queuing delay. The key insight is that in a controlled queue, the queue always becomes empty. The queue is, if your processing speed is greater than your arrival speed, then over some period of time, you have to process all the requests that came in. So the logic behind controlled delay is pretty simple. If there's a queue and it has been, and you see that over the last, say, 10, 15 seconds, at some point it was fully drained, we do nothing. But if we see that within the last 10 seconds, you weren't able to consume all the requests that came into your service, we set a timeout that's very small of the amount of time something can be in the queue. We limit it to something around 10 to 30 milliseconds. So the result of this is good queues aren't affected because over a period of 10 to 15 seconds, they're always eventually drained. Bad queues, we quickly detect them, and we limit the amount of delay that they can cause. A second mechanism we have, and this is also something we've open sourced, is something called adaptive LIFO. So the insight here is that if you have a queue that's FIFO, which is how most queues work, then the request you serve is always the one that has been waiting for the longest. It's the one that's already experienced the most delay. And what we've often found is that we have a system and the queuing delay was 30 seconds. And the user, by 30 seconds, has already aborted the request. They've already done something else, gone to another web page, used another mobile app. And so often, we end up servicing a request that will never see the light of day. The user will never experience the response to that request. The idea behind adaptive LIFO is that we'd be better off servicing a request that the user was more likely to see. And so what adaptive LIFO does is, under normal low-load circumstances, it's a normal FIFO queue. But as soon as we see the occupancy of the queue rise to a level that's sort of atypical of the service, then we switch it into LIFO mode. And what happens then is, then we're servicing requests. We're not letting them experience the queuing delay. Eventually, the control delay algorithm will come in. It will pick up on the fact that there's a sustained queue, and it will time out the other requests that are in the queue. So what all of this does together is, this makes the service notice when there's queuing, and it makes it more proactive about telling the person who's calling that service, hey, I've got a lot of queuing. I'm going to reject your request. And that helps the user's response just, you know, continue moving along. And maybe the service they were calling has an error, but we can continue to process the rest of their request. Now, we have a philosophy of trying to fix performance problems in servers, but also making clients not trust that servers have the best of intentions. And what we do is we've built in the philosophy of concurrency control into a lot of our services. So the philosophy here is services often have a limited resource, the number of requests that they can be processing at any given time. What we don't want to see is, we don't want to see one service monopolizing all of its resources in attempting to talk to another service that just isn't working. So the idea of concurrency control is that we cap the number of concurrent requests that can be going to any given service. So some examples of how we use this at Facebook is, we have a system called memcache leases. The idea of memcache leases is that for a given memcache key, it might be something that, you know, the data behind that memcache key isn't available. It's a really hot object that's database is overloaded. We notice that 1,000 different requests at the same time see a miss on that key and are trying to refill it. And rather than having all of them slam the backend resource behind that object, we tell them, hey, this object isn't available. There's a lot of your friends are also trying to get this object. Just fail quickly. Don't even try going to the backend service behind this. For Thrift, again, our RPC framework between different services, we do the same thing. On a given server, we'll notice that, you know, a large number of requests are all trying to talk to a specific backend service. And we say, hey, you know what? You and all your friends are all trying to talk to messages, or you're all trying to talk to ads or newsfeed or some other backend service in our site. And we tell them, you know what? This service doesn't really seem to be working very well. Don't even try. And what this tends to do is, this tends to prevent a catastrophic failure in one service from propagating and affecting all of the things that the client of that service does. So I want to talk about a setting that you can actually fix today in the Linux kernel. It's something that saves Facebook from going down, and it's a great example of where trying too hard can really cause you a problem. So this is the TCP abort and overflow setting. When Linux gets a SYN, when it gets a new incoming TCP connection, if there are too many connections waiting to be accepted, its behavior is to drop the packet. Now, why would you drop the packet? The theory, and what the kernel documentation says, is that this increases the reliability of your system. Because the client will see the packet was dropped, just as if there was a normal drop in the network, and it'll try again later. So this will make your system more reliable. What happens in practice? In practice, the server that can't accept the incoming connections is simply overloaded. Trying again won't help, and it also adds 1 to 3 seconds of delay, depending on what kernel version you're using, when the server tries to send the packet again. In a server world, 1 to 3 seconds is an eternity. The TCP abort and overflow setting simply tells the kernel to send a TCP reset when it experiences an overloaded queue. We have found that this setting has actually prevented Facebook from going down. It has, you know, prevented an otherwise working set of services from causing a catastrophic failure. And it's a great example of where better managing queues can help manage the reliability of your service. So, one of the things the Web Foundation team does, and sort of part of our mission, is proactive investigation of performance issues. So proactively going to service owners and telling them something like, hey, the TCP abort on overflow setting isn't set correctly, and this will really help the reliability of your service. So sometimes investigating stuff feels a little bit like an X-file. There's a lot of unexplained phenomena in all of our systems, and you're kind of trying to figure out what's going on. So a lot of people ask me, why do you investigate things? Why, you know, the culture of the sort of like the SRE or the PE culture is that we should be driven by alarms. We shouldn't be an operational team. We should be focused on, you know, on building things and not sitting and watching dashboards. So I think that's definitely true, but I think that the activity of monitoring a dashboard without knowing that something is wrong and sort of digging in and investigating a problem can really help you in a lot of ways. A lot of times there are things that you don't know about your system. There's you know, problems that you don't even know how to monitor for. You don't even have the metrics that you're looking at. I thought that an investigation often uncovers new metrics that you can monitor in the long run and that make it easier to debug your system. I found that investigation also helps you catch issues before they have high impact. Oftentimes, through proactive investigation, we'll find an issue that was happening on 1% of requests that if we'd waited a week, it would have been rolled out to 100% of requests. But that by proactively monitoring the system and proactively looking for issues, we detect it before it's a big problem. Finally, I think that good investigation promotes good debugging workflows. And good debugging workflows save you time during a crisis and make it faster for you to recover. So to me, an investigation has two parts, a metric and a way of grouping that metric. A metric is a statistic you want to investigate, and a grouping is a way of categorizing that metric to help you find interesting changes. So there are some obvious metrics in a lot of systems. There's, you know, RAM usage, CPU usage, disk I/O. We're all monitoring those. There's a number of other metrics that I found people don't think of as the first thing, but are really useful to monitor. The TCP stack is really rich with a lot of monitoring statistics that can tell you about the performance of your network and the performance of your applications, even if application developers do nothing to help monitor your system. So one thing TCP can tell you is TCP resets. That is when a TCP connection was forcefully aborted. This can tell you about a service that is timing out requests, about a service that's crashing, about a service that isn't even running. It tells you a lot of things that, you know, are just going wrong in terms of the overall networking stack and being able to serve requests. Another super useful metric, probably the most useful TCP metric, is TCP retransmissions. TCP retransmits responses to create the illusion of a reliable network on top of an inherently unreliable network. So when TCP has to resend a packet to create reliability, that tells you that something is wrong with your underlying network. So TCP retransmissions can tell you about NICs that are broken. It can tell you about network cables that are broken. It can tell you about switches and routers that aren't working correctly. We've even instrumented our kernel so that the kernel logs every single TCP retransmission we make, and it has the source and the destination of that TCP retransmission. We aggregate that information across a large set of Facebook systems, and that can tell us really useful information. Like, we will see spikes in retransmissions from data center A to data center B. We can then go to the networking team and say, hey, you know, I see that the packets between point A and point B are being dropped. Is there something wrong? Is one of the switches overloaded? So that statistic has been super useful for us, and it's something that's pretty easy to monitor. Finally, TCP has a number of other statistics, like the number of open sockets, the number of app connections that you're making, a lot of stuff that can give you a lot of insight into your application, even if you don't add any monitoring whatsoever. Another really useful metric I've found is that the number of requests where a certain operation took more than a certain number of milliseconds. A lot of times people look at the averages, but the averages don't tell you everything about the performance of an application. They often miss the outlier requests that are taking a long time. The number of errors of a specific type, if you can monitor not just the rate of errors, but break them down and find a specific error that just started or the increase in frequency, that often tells you about a change in your system. I often ask people if they, you know, when they're developing code, to develop counters around the number of times a certain rare code path is hit. So that if you don't think that something is going to be hit very often, fine, have the code there, instrument it, and when it does hit, that's an interesting opportunity for us to investigate what happened. Finally, I talked a lot about queuing. queuing tends to be a universally useful metric in debugging performance problems in a system. Anytime there's a queue, I like to ask application developers, hey, like, is there monitoring around that queue? Can I tell how large it is, how long people have been waiting in it? So one thing I found is that often the metric that you choose is really important to select the right metric so that it's the changes in it are obvious. So this is a graph, I actually took this morning, of two ways of monitoring the same thing. One way, I monitored the average latency of the thing, and that's the black line that's at the top. The second line on the bottom is the number of requests to this service that took over a second. So you can, and this is both of the axes on this are zero-based. So you can see both of them have spikes, both of them change. But when you look at the average latency, the spike is sort of, you know, along the lines of the normal service response time. It's elevated, but it's not clearly disastrous. The bottom one, the number of requests that took more than a second, is an order of magnitude higher than the normal rate. Choosing the right metric so that the problems sort of stand out like this can be really important in doing an investigation. So once you have a metric, you figure out how to group it. There's lots of ways to group things. You can group things by time. Even time at a sub-second level, we found to be really interesting. We found people that are doing operations where they, you know, use a timer API that was naturally aligned to 1 second intervals. Grouping by physical location. You know, you can find that one server that's broken or that one rack of servers where someone launched an experiment doing something weird. Grouping by request type. We like to sort of figure out whether or not a specific type of error or issue is related to a specific type of request or a type of service. The more ways you have to break down these metrics, the more interesting spikes you can see, because the more likely the spikes will be dramatic and will be something you want to investigate deeper. Finally, I really like grouping by histogram bucket. Often, if you take the latency of something and you draw a distribution of it, you'll see spikes around weird values. Like, you'll see a spike at 1.5 seconds or 200 milliseconds. These often correspond to underlying timeouts or parameters in your system that might need to be adjusted. So when you're doing investigation, I found that it's really important to spend some time visualizing things. So this is some data from the same data set, and it's formatted in two different ways. The bottom one is just way easier to read than the top one. The bottom one has fixed point font, the decimal points are aligned, and the units are clear. In the top one, the units are all over the place. It's impossible to tell whether 40.0 is greater than or less to 196, because when you look at it, nothing is aligned. Nothing makes sense when you just scan that list of numbers. I found that it's just really important to spend time visualizing the data set that you have. So a frequent subset of this problem is people just complain that their dashboards are a mess. These are some real-world Facebook dashboards. You'll see the top two graphs measure the same thing. They have they have different x-axes and y-axes, and their units weren't labeled. You can't get any information from this graph. And the top graph, the y-axis, got screwed up by something that happened in the left-hand side of the graph, and you can't see any data from the right-hand side of the graph. In the bottom graph, we have like a CPU usage utilization metric that has like 20 different lines, and they're just scattered all over the place. You can't tell what is correlated to what, or, you know, what patterns might be there. And it's really impossible to tell if you're looking, you know, if you're trying to match something to the labeling of the chart, whether you're looking for like the fuchsia or the magenta line, because there's just so many lines and so many colors, you can't make any sense of it. So we really like this framework called Cubism. It's open source. It's something that Square developed. And it's kind of an eyeful at first, but we found it's a really useful way to scan a lot of operational data. In fact, a former colleague who I met here told me that the first thing he did, he said, I want to have Cubism at the company I'm at, because it's just a fundamentally easier way to look at data. So what is all of this data? If you look at the top graph here, all of these are the graphs of the same value. On the top graph, you have a 120 pixel version of this chart. And then we squashed it down to 30 pixels. And it's kind of hard to read the 30 pixel version of it, because you can't really see the peaks and valleys and the details of what's happening in this data set. On the bottom, we've done what cubism does, which is create horizon graphs. Horizon graphs, rather than squashing the pixels, they chop the data set up into four different parts, and they label them with different colors. And then those parts are collapsed on top of each other. So the darker values indicate higher values in the underlying chart. But the shape of the chart looks the same. So it's a lot easier to see the data in the chart that uses cubism because it uses color to increase the density of the information. The density of cubism is pretty amazing. You can fit one data set, one line in the chart in 30 vertical pixels. And horizontally, one day of data at 1 minute resolution or 6 hours of data at 15 second resolution only takes 1,440 pixels. So it's really high resolution. It's really easy to see what's going on in a cubism graph because you can put a lot of data there. Cubism encourages you to sort of set the y-axis of your graph manually. And what this does is this prevents an outlier from completely screwing up all of your other graphs. It makes sure that you can still see what was happening the rest of the day, even if at like 5 p.m., you know, stuff really went wrong and like all your stuff went off the charts. The real power of cubism, I think, is in the ability to correlate different events. If you have a lot of lines that are all over the place and a lot of lines in different colors, you can't really tell whether the lines that changed were all from the same data center or whether they were just scattered around. You can't even match them up with the labeling of the chart because you have to match all the colors to the data sets. With cubism, it's really easy. The darker colors indicate higher values, and you can see patterns of sort of streaks in the cubism chart that represent operational changes. One of the things we've done with cubism that I really like is that we've not just made it into, it's not just a visualization, it's also a workflow. We have two parts of our workflow. One is that you can easily flip between different metrics just by hovering over sort of a list of metrics that we've defined for a given data set. Secondly, we've made it so you can drag and drop a specific area of a graph you're interested in, and we build sub-dashboards for each one of these metrics that tell you if this metric was elevated, say if the response time for Memcache was elevated, it's a follow-up dashboard that gives you all the things you might want to look at after that. I've seen a lot of people, they'll set up their system so they have a graph that monitors Memcache, but then their next step is they've got to like log into a bunch of servers or they've got to like type in a bunch of commands into their dashboarding system to come up with interesting graphs. This just makes it a one-step process. You define what time point you're looking at. It automatically sets all the graphs to the correct time point, and anybody can contribute new graphs as part of the drill down data set. So I think a lot of these tools are, there's a lot of tools here we have for investigation. And sometimes we aren't able to proactively prevent an incident from happening. Sometimes we actually have to respond to a problem as it happens. And I think there's really two important things in responding to an incident that I'm going to talk about. One is the communication that goes on during the incident. And then the second part is what we do to follow up from the incident and how we make sure the incident doesn't happen again. So at Facebook, we have three ways of communicating during an incident. We communicate either in person, on IRC, and occasionally we'll use the phone. Most of the time, we're either on IRC or we're in person. And I think the reason why the phone doesn't work very well is because the IRC has a log of what's going on. Everyone can see what's going on. If you've been on a conference call with 20 people who are trying to debug why Facebook is down, it's really chaotic. No one can communicate information to each other. When you're in person, you can show someone your laptop and show them a set of graphs. If you're on IRC, you can send them a link to those graphs. If you're on the phone, everyone is just having a shouting match and is trying to talk over each other. So we've generally found that those two methods are the primary methods we end up using for communicating during an incident. Another thing that I think has been really helpful is that we have an internal tool, we call it Sev Manager internally, Sev being our sort of like code name for an incident. And it's a place where everyone can keep track of the incidents that are going on. Just having a record of what problems happened, when they happened, what people are doing about them can be really helpful in coordinating all the incidents that go on at Facebook every day. The other thing is that Sev Manager gives you a history of what happened during a Sev. when you look at it later, then you can go and look through the information and write something down so that when you're doing a post-mortem analysis, you can easily figure out what people were thinking at a given point in time. We have a role at Facebook called the Incident Manager on Call. That's the IMOCs are a group of incident handlers that are really skilled at sort of communicating during incidents and can help people sort of with the soft side of resolving problems. So one thing that I found in just dealing with major incidents is that it's really easy to lose the big picture. During a major incident, you've got a lot of people that are on their laptops looking at charts, looking at graphs, trying to figure out what's going wrong. And it's really easy to just miss the big picture of what's going on and what direction you're heading and just be heads down in the details of resolving the incident. So I like to kind of think of questions to ask during an incident that can help sort of prompt people to think about the bigger pictures. So some of the things I like to think about are what can we do quickly to mitigate the impact of this incident? Oftentimes, reverting is the fastest way to solve a problem. Other times, there's a configuration value you can change. You can turn off a feature that's just broken and it's a better user experience to have the feature be off than just to be broken. Another great question to ask is just what is everybody doing right now and what is our plan of attack? Oftentimes, there's a lot of people on their laptops kind of a little bit uncoordinated, and just understanding what everybody is looking at and what they want to do next can really help drive decisions about what the next step is to recovery. Along with that, understanding the current hypothesis and understanding exactly what information you could gather that would prove or disprove the current hypothesis. It's always a guess what's going on. Until you fix the problem, you never really know what it is. And making sure that you're collecting data to validate the current hypothesis is really important. Is there an alternate strategy we can pursue? Oftentimes, people are kind of have momentum of one way of fixing an incident, and someone just needs to say, hey, have we tried doing this? Is there a faster way to solve this problem? And making sure there's just someone who's combating any built-in momentum against the current plan and thinking about possible alternatives. Another really important question is what are we going to need to do in 10 minutes? Oftentimes, the road to recovery from a major incident is long. There might be some parts of the process that might need to be a little bit more manual. There might be some follow-up steps of restarting a service that was impacted by with collateral damage from the incident. Asking the question, what we're going to need to do 10 minutes from now, can help make sure that that step is primed and that somebody starts thinking about what they need to do and what work is going to need to be followed up on. And priming that makes sure that the response that you don't solve one problem and then kind of have to, we're going to have to restart this thing, let's now think about that. It helps get parallelism in the process of resolving the incident. Finally, the question of, is there anybody else we should call? If your site is down, don't be hesitant to call someone. It's better to have a false alarm and to wake someone up unnecessarily than it is to have extra delay in recovering from an incident. So once an incident happens, it's over, but I think it's really important to learn from what happened during that incident and turn it into action items that can improve your system in the long run. Facebook does a weekly review of selected incidents that happen on the site. And a lot of teams do their own reviews of incidents that have happened within their team. The goal of doing this one review, there's three goals in doing one of these reviews. The goals are to share knowledge about what happened, to make sure people are understanding the kinds of ways that Facebook is failing and the kinds of issues that we're encountering, document what happened when we were handling the incident, and then come up with action items that make Facebook more reliable in the long run. So I think there's a few things that are really important not to do when you're reviewing an incident. Getting an invitation, so-called invitation, to one of these incident reviews can be a little bit intimidating. And I've seen a lot of people be nervous the first time they go into one of these incident reviews. These reviews are not punishments. They are not telling people that they're doing a bad job. They are learning about how to recover from our mistakes. The second mistake that I see people frequently doing is they come to the incident review and they say, we did X wrong, we're not going to do X again. well, of course you're not going to do X again. You're not going to fail the same way twice. That's like that's silly. That's you're just not going to do that. People need to assume that they're going to things are going to break in a slightly different way. That they're not going to maybe detect at first glance, and come up with action items that will fix the issues generically. So a coworker of mine came up with a really great framework for thinking about ways to follow up action items from an incident. And this is called DERP. So the idea of DERP is to address the detection, escalation, remediation, and prevention of an incident. Detection means, did you detect the issue automatically? Did you see it through your alarms? And once you saw the issue through your alarms, the follow-up question to that is, did the monitoring that you had, did that make it intuitive to figure out the root cause of the problem? Monitoring is not just an alerting system, it's also a debugging system. And I sort of talked about the way we build debugging workflows. If your monitoring wasn't a good debugging workflow for that incident, then you should figure out what do you do to make the incident easier to debug next time, given your monitoring tools. Escalation. Did the right people get involved quickly? If one team had to call another team, why didn't that second team get an alert? Why weren't they on the scene already? Oftentimes, an issue will sort of be part of multiple layers of the site. And we want to make sure that we detect the issue at each one of those layers so that the right teams get involved. Remediation. What did you do to fix the issue? If oftentimes the longest part of the downtime isn't debugging what the issue was, it was doing all the steps you needed to do to bring everything back up. So I think during an incident review, thinking about the ways you could automate the process of recovering something and make it faster can increase your reliability simply by making your recovery time faster. Finally, and I think this is the most important question, is prevention. Not just saying we're not going to do this again, but what, given that this will happen again, what will make it safer? What will remove the risk? What will make it fail gracefully? What will make it fail fast? What will reduce the impact of this failure to users? These are the kinds of things that, maybe the next time this issue happens, it'll be, a big issue, or it'll be a small issue rather than a big issue. Finally, I think it's really important in these kinds of reviews to get people to think bigger than their own team. So incident reviews should be a way to push global changes that impact multiple parts of your system. Oftentimes, I'll see someone come into an incident review, and they'll tell about a way to recover, about a sort of an action item, a follow-up item, and phrase it in terms of their own team. So for example, imagine a team, there's a team that runs a critical feature on Facebook, and that feature starts failing. It starts throwing exceptions. And the data about these exceptions were lost in the noise because this feature is critical, but it has a small amount of traffic. Oftentimes, they'll see them come to the incident review and say, you know what, we should really be monitoring for exceptions in our service. Well, that's great, but what about the next service that comes along, the next service that has a rare but important feature? How are they going to prevent the same thing from happening? The follow-up item you really want from this kind of incident is to ask the question, is our monitoring system well-tuned for the diversity of teams that we have and the diversity of products that we're running? Coming up with an action item that doesn't just address the issue that happened, but also thinks bigger and tries to make the infrastructure more resilient is more likely to prevent other incidents from happening in the long run. So I think in an incident review, this is sort of like the role of an experienced incident handler, is to ask these questions that maybe the team actually needs more support from the monitoring team. And the experienced incident handler can then champion those kinds of action items and explain to people why improving the monitoring system will improve the reliability of that site overall. Cool, so that's my talk. I'm open to questions here. I think we also have a Facebook happy hour afterwards that I'll be at, and you guys can ask me questions. Cool, you.
The one group of folks I know who implemented cubism said that they eventually got tired of explaining to people how to read the graphs. What have you done in terms of education, or do you just keep it to your
company? Yeah, my boss asked me how to read the graphs, and I still think he's a little bit confused. He doesn't look at it every day. I don't know, to me, like, the first time I looked at it, it was kind of intuitive. I don't really know how to explain anymore. I was going to try to come up with, like, an animation for it, which I think might be the only way to, like, truly explain it. I think once you started using it for a while, you kind of get it. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's pretty well documented, and I'm confused as well as to why it's so, like, it's something that people seem to either get or not get. And yeah, I feel like a lot of people just kind of understood how to use it over time. But I completely feel your pain there. Yeah, you? So I think there's, you know, we have an underlying data system called ODS, which stores all of our operational monitoring data. And you can write a lot of scripts on top of that or a lot of different visualizations. Cubism literally started off as a like cron job that ran every minute and that pulled a bunch of data from our monitoring system and spit it out as JSON. Like, you know, you can take lots of information and you can visualize it in different ways. And I think that one of the important parts of doing data visualization work is just making prototypes like that that build on top of existing systems and that take data and transform it in new and unique and interesting ways. Yeah?
Do you have any thoughts on how to train new people to be SREs?
So I think that attending one of these incident reviews is actually something that's really useful. I've like learned a lot even from incidents that I haven't been involved with. Just sitting and listening to people review incidents and understanding what happened, I think is something that's really important. And so I encourage a lot of people that are just starting out to, you know, go to one of these incident reviews, even if they don't have something that, you know, they're responsible for. I find oftentimes being one of the people who is responsible for causing one of the incidents enhances that learning experience. Probably not something you want to encourage, but actually being on the scene when people are responding to an incident, especially if you can do it in a way that, you know, you have support from the rest of your team, I think is a really good learning experience. Someone over here had a question? You, yeah? I mean, we definitely have some mechanisms in place. Like the fact that a lot of the conversation happens on IRC, like means that there's, you know, at least some level of data about what was going on. There's definitely been times where, you know, oh man, I wish we'd like recorded this graph before we like switched it to 15-minute granularity. And one nice thing that's helpful is that we, you know, we keep the highest granularity of our data for you know enough time that, you know, we're not just losing it after 24 hours. You know, it's there while we're sort of doing the post-mortem analysis. So as long as you're, you know, keeping the highest resolution data for like a week or so, I think it's you know, you usually have enough to go on for any reasonable post-mortem. Yeah. So in terms of monitoring thrift services, what we do is all of our thrift clients log, you know, one and n samples of thrift calls that they make, and they log that through Scribe. And that data set we display in a system called Scuba, which there's an open paper on. It's basically an easy way to sort of slice and dice data sets and ask questions like, you know, what happened in this cluster with this service at this given time. So basically the idea is you sort of log a sample of data. Oftentimes we try to oversample things that we think are errors or that are slower than we would expect. So we have higher resolution data on that. And asynchronously we monitor it. And then we also monitor, we have sort of, you know, real-time time series, you know, that are, you know, higher resolution, they're unsampled, but they aren't, you know, they aren't granular records of a single thing that happened. They are aggregates of, you know, what happened over 1 sec, over 1 minute on one machine. It really depends on what the data is. You know, different data sets, there's no reason to keep information about, you know, like sampled RPC calls between servers for a super long time. There are other data sets that are interesting to analyze over, you know, over months or years. So like, you know, things that relate to like, you know, planning capacity you might want to keep for longer than things you want to relate to, you know, like how a service is operating. Cool. Any other questions? All right. Well, you can find me. I'll be at the Facebook happy hour after this. Thank you.